Welcome to the Anxiety Summit, Season 2. This is Trudy Scott, food mood expert, certified nutritionist, and author of the Anti-Anxiety Food Solution. And as you know, anxiety can have many causes. Nutritional deficiencies is a common one. And did you know that certain drugs can lead to very specific nutritional deficiencies? Deficiencies of certain nutrients that may in fact be calming, such as magnesium, or even key nutrients that are needed to make our calming neurotransmitters, such as zinc and vitamin B6. Today, our topic is drug-induced nutritional deficiencies that contribute to anxiety. And our guest expert is Dr. Peter Osborne. A very big welcome to you today, Dr. Osborne.
Well, thank you, Tree. I'm honored to be here and be able to present to your summit.
Thanks so much for being here. I know this is one of your areas of expertise, and I think it's an important one that we don't want to overlook, because we can be eating healthy food and we can be doing all the other good things that we need to be doing, but if it is the medications that we are taking that is contributing to the anxiety, then we obviously need to deal with that aspect as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So many times in my clinic, as I see patients, you know, one of the biggest holdups once their diet changes and they really start dialing in on their lifestyle is the persistent use of chronic medications and those untoward side effects on their nutritional status.
Great. So let me just read your bio and then we'll get right into the topic because it's an important one. Dr. Peter Osborne is the clinical director of Town Center Wellness in Sugar Land, Texas, just southwest of Houston. He is a doctor of chiropractic medicine and a board-certified clinical nutritionist. He's an expert in orthomolecular and functional medicine. He has been practicing since 2001. His clinical focus is the holistic, natural treatment of chronic degenerative diseases with a primary focus on gluten sensitivity and food allergies. He has helped thousands of patients recover from mysterious medical illnesses. Dr. Osborne received his doctorate from Texas Chiropractic College. He has held faculty teaching positions at Texas Women's University and HCC's nursing program, teaching neurophysiology, nutrition, biology, and anatomy and physiology. He lectures nationally to doctors on the topics of gluten sensitivity intolerance, celiac disease, drug-induced nutritional deficiencies, and many other nutritionally related topics. He's the co-founder of NutraMD, a nutritional supplement product line that addresses nutrient deficiencies caused by commonly prescribed medications. He's the host for a radio program, Alternatives for Health and Wellness, and the executive secretary for the American Clinical Board of Nutrition. He founded Gluten Free Society in 2010 to help educate patients and physicians on the far-reaching effects of gluten sensitivity. He's the author of Glutenology, a series of books designed to help educate the world about gluten. I think it's quite ironic that you come from a place called Sugarland.
I get that a lot. So my office is in Sugarland and the street is on Sweetwater. So we have all these kind of connotations towards sugar, yeah.
Very funny. Anyway, let's get into our topic, drug-induced nutritional deficiencies that cause anxiety. Before we get into that, I just would love you to explain your victim-warrior concept, because I think it's really important, because someone may be listening to this and think, oh my gosh, I'm taking meds and this is going to be a big problem for me. But I watched one of your videos and you talk about not being a victim and instead being a warrior, and I'd love you to just share that just to get people a little bit upbeat about this.
Absolutely. Well, I'm a big advocate for people empowering themselves and being able to educate themselves about what changes they can make to improve their situation. In the world today, we are all so disease-focused. Doctors want to give a diagnosis for a condition. And I believe that giving a diagnosis for a condition actually serves to disempower a person's ability to make real change in their health. In essence, the doctor says, poor you, Mrs. Jones, you have anxiety, there's really nothing we can do about it other than it's probably a chemical imbalance, and here's a chemical to help to try to counter that chemical imbalance. Well, that takes the power completely away from the patient, and puts the power completely in the hands of the medication. And the bottom line is this. No one ever developed anxiety as a deficiency for medication. In other words, nobody's cause of anxiety is a deficiency of a drug. And if we blame it on a chemical imbalance, then at least we should empower the patient to help to identify what that chemical imbalance is so that they can become a warrior advocate of their own health, so that they can become, again, empowered to make intelligent decisions about where that imbalance is coming from, so that they can do everything in their own power to change their health without needing the medicine for the rest of their lives.
Excellent. I love it. Very good. And I love that term empower, because if we know what the problem is and we know that there's something that we can do about it, then we can do something about it instead of just feeling like I'm a victim. Oh my gosh, what am I going to do? So I think that's very powerful. Okay, let's get right into the topic. What does this term drug-induced nutritional deficiencies actually mean?
That's a great question. Drug-induced nutritional deficiencies has been a problem since the advent of drugs. And it doesn't matter what kind of drug we're talking about. We go back into history and we look at, you know, one of the prime, I think one of the leading drugs that led to pharmaceutical control over the healthcare industry, which is the antibiotic, because it was such a miraculous drug. And I want to start by saying that drugs aren't evil, and I don't believe that drugs are evil. I think in today's society they're overutilized and overabused, and they're used in situations for lifelong treatment as opposed to temporary treatment while doctors try to ascertain the origin of the patient's disease. But that being said, if we look at just the antibiotic in and of itself, it created a kind of godlike complex where it saved so many lives that the drug itself took on a life of its own. The untoward effects, so when we talk about drug-induced nutritional deficiencies, what we're referring to are the unknown, at least for many years, the unknown side effects of the drug. In other words, why do so many drugs have so many different side effects? One of those reasons actually has to do with drug-induced nutritional deficiencies. I'm not the first doctor to talk about this topic. As a matter of fact, Alicia graduated at Stanford, but her name is Daphne Rowe. She's a medical doctor, and she wrote a book, and it was all about how many medications either interfered with how vitamins were absorbed, they interfered with how vitamins were taken up by cells, they interfered with the receptor sites where vitamins would bind. So these drug-induced nutritional deficiencies can happen in a multitude of different ways. Most recently, a group of pharmacists put together a book called The Drug-Induced Nutritional Depletion Handbook. The lead author on that project, his name was Ross Pelton, and he was just trying to make the world much more aware that when using medications, especially the doctors, when prescribing medications to patients, if we're using a medication that causes a vitamin or a mineral deficiency, and the side effects of the vitamin and mineral deficiency are the same or create the same kind of scenario or situation that the disease we're treating creates as well. In essence, I'm going to use an example here. Let's say a woman is taking a birth control pill and she's on it for a number of years. Well, birth control pills interfere with magnesium. And one of the deficiency symptoms of magnesium is anxiety. So here we are, maybe treating a woman with hormones to help with her anxiety. Over a number of years, we actually induce a nutritional loss that induces anxiety. So where are we left? Where does that leave us? That leaves us with a dependency on a medication that creates a secondary diagnosis that doesn't ever get diagnosed because nobody's looking for nutritional loss.
Very interesting. So we're causing other problems with these medications, and then someone may be prescribed another medication because the anxiety has got worse, and it just becomes a vicious cycle.
Exactly.
So just going back to your comments about these books, I'm familiar with Ross Pelton's book, Drug-Induced Nutritional Deficiencies, which is fabulous. And you mentioned a book by Daphne, and I didn't catch her last name. What was that last name?
Daphne Rowe, R-O-E.
Okay.
And her, I believe her first copy was in the 1970s when her original book was written. I actually found it on a cobweb-ridden shelf in the library in graduate school. When I pulled it down, this is where I developed a passion for understanding the biochemistry behind drug-induced nutritional loss. And so her book was my first exposure into this realm.
Very interesting, because that's a long time ago that this has been talked about, and in actual fact, it's not well recognized, and you don't hear a lot of people talking about it. So I appreciate your passion for this, and I appreciate her, obviously, and Ross Pelton and his team for highlighting it, because I think it's something important that we need to be aware of. So you've mentioned antibiotics, and you've mentioned the birth control pill, but let's talk a little bit more specifically about specific medications that can lead to this problem and then in turn either trigger or contribute to anxiety.
Okay, so let's start with one of the most common, and then we'll go into some of the others that also create problems. I think for women, one of the most common is actual the estrogen pill, whether they're being taken as birth control or whether they're being taken to help with acne or taken to control cycles or hormones. Some doctors still prescribe birth control pills or estrogen pills for bone loss. So just depending on the reason the woman might be taking it, it's just very clear, I want to be very clear, that it's estrogen that has this impact and this effect. And before I get into it, I will also say this, because a lot of doctors ask me, well, what about bioidentical hormones versus synthetic hormones? And there is no research that has studied whether there's a difference between the two. So I'll just be clear that what we're referring to, the research that we're referring to, largely has to do with prescriptive estrogen-based hormone that is not bioidentical. So I don't think we have any research that would delineate the difference between the two.
Okay.
One of the most common nutritional side effects of estrogen prescriptive pills is magnesium loss. Now, magnesium is an extremely important mineral. It plays a role in more than 300 chemical reactions in the human body. Of those 300 chemical reactions, several of them have to do with the proper utilization and the proper metabolism of estrogen. In essence, how do women excrete estrogen so that it doesn't build up in their system and contribute to different forms of cancer? Well, this is done through a particular enzyme system that magnesium drives or runs. And this same enzyme system, it's actually called COMT, catecholomethyltransferase, which is just a fancy way of talking about this enzyme. This enzyme is, again, it's magnesium-driven. This very same enzyme is extremely important for neurochemical production in the brain and neurochemical production in the gut. And so what happens to a lot of women over time as they develop this magnesium deficiency is they can get a reduction in their serotonin, a reduction in dopamine. And both of these chemicals, again, have impact on normal neurotransmission through the brain. So side effects can be excessive anxiety. Side effects can also be depression. They can also be gastrointestinal side effects. So some women will develop IBS-like symptoms as a result of this because of the impact magnesium has on serotonin production in the GI tract. Now, it's also important to say that when we talk about drug-induced nutritional deficiencies, I'm not talking about a person using a medication for a day or a week. Most of these problems exert their effect over a long period of use, 6 months or more. So the longer the person's on the medication, the longer we tend to see the nutritional deficiencies develop. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. So with birth control pills and estrogen, magnesium is one of the main culprits. Another culprit is folate. Now, folate is a B vitamin. It's oftentimes referred to as vitamin B9. Sometimes it's referred to as biopterin. But folate is a very, very important B vitamin whose one of its primary roles is in the conversion of neurotransmitters. So it helps to take neurotransmitters as they don't work, and it helps to activate them. And so an example might be when we make, initially, when we're trying to make serotonin, there are several precursor steps on the path to making serotonin, and folate helps in driving those steps forward so that we get to the end result, which is what we're after, serotonin. Now, many of the listeners, if they've tuned in to any health summits in the past, and I'm sure you're addressing this as well, is there's a process known as methylation.
Mm-hmm.
Methylation is a chemical process where basically we're adding a carbon and three hydrogens to a molecule to activate it. And this is done primarily in the brain. There's a lot of this that goes on in the brain, and the lack of methylation can cause extreme anxiety and anxiety-based problems. So folate, again, is one of the key B vitamins necessary for the methylation process to work effectively. Some patients, some women actually have a genetic mutation in their ability to methylate as it relates to folic acid or folate, and so some doctors will actually measure the 5-MTHF genes that measure this for this genetic mutation. So if you take a woman who has this genetic mutation, she's already predisposed for the risk of developing anxiety problems as a result of too little folate, and now you add a medication that causes the depletion of that very same nutrient. Now we have kind of a double hit here. And so not only did she have a genetic, remember, genetics don't dictate disease. They just lay out the course for predisposition to problems. But if we got somebody with a genetic predisposition and you add a medication that exacerbates that genetic predisposition, now we can spell out the kind of the course of, okay, this is going to lead to symptomatic response that someday some doctor is going to diagnose as anxiety and start prescribing additional medication.
Great. So we've got this, someone may have this defect in their methylation process, the MTH, they might show positive for the MTHFR gene, and the fact that they are taking the synthetic estrogen, or even possibly the bioidentical, because as you say, we don't know if the bioidentical hormones are doing similar, then it's going to make things even worse for them.
Absolutely. Now when we add another nutrient that we know estrogen, synthetic estrogens will deplete, it's vitamin B6.
Mm-hmm.
And vitamin B6 also plays a central role in that same methylation pathway that we were just referring to. And so we can, you know, again, through the use of estrogen, we can induce vitamin B6 deficiency. And so now that's going to start affecting how we get rid of homocysteine, homocysteine being a metabolic byproduct that we all produce that can exacerbate or contribute to anxiety disorders.
And I see vitamin B6 to be such a common deficiency anyway with so many of my clients with anxiety, and we know how important it is when it comes to social anxiety, the social anxiety condition called pyroluria. And a lot of women with PMS-type symptoms and hormonal imbalance, you know, B6 is a factor there as well. So adding in these medications that are going to further deplete B6 is a big problem.
It absolutely is. And, you know, my advice is, you know, again, I want to reiterate that medicine isn't necessarily evil. If you're on it, your goal should only be short-term use with some type of lifestyle adjustment or change that will lead to the lack of need for a medication. But if you're on it for any length of time, you should have the conversation, should go down like this with your doctor. You should say, you know, Dr. Jones, I'm aware that this medication can deplete certain vitamins and minerals. Can we test those vitamins and minerals for as long as I'm taking this medication periodically to ensure that it's not creating that issue for me? Or at the very least, can you put me on some type of very strong, high-quality, multivitamin, multimineral formula that is going to have a tendency to offset some of these nutritional deficits that can occur? It's just common sense. We can cover nutritional bases if we know drugs cause nutrient depletion by just making small and inexpensive changes.
Great. And I know we're going to talk about testing and the importance of these quality nutrients a little bit later. So I'm glad you brought that up here, because if someone is on one of these drugs, they need to know, as you said earlier, they need to be empowered and know that it's causing a particular deficiency or possibly causing this deficiency, testing and seeing what it is and then doing something about it, which is power. We don't have to just sit there and wait for the problem to happen. We can do something about it.
Absolutely. Yeah, waiting for the problem to happen. What the old saying is, failing to plan is planning to fail. And when it comes to your health, that's a bad idea.
Mm-hmm. Now that you mentioned this estrogen. So it's the estrogen in, can you just mention some of these places that we're talking about? Is it the birth control pill? And then estrogen also for someone who may be going through menopause, is it, any many different kinds of drugs that could be contributing to these deficiencies you've just talked about?
Yeah, absolutely. So whether it's for, contraception or through hormone regulation, balancing a period, controlling acne, and some doctors will use estrogens during menopause. A lot of doctors, make the recommendation of using estrogen and progesterone and cortisol as just a general treatment protocol for any woman who's starting to have a natural hormone decline. So these are all areas where, again, if you've been prescribed estrogen for any of those reasons, you just want to have that conversation and be aware that those are possibilities.
Mm-hmm. Great. And I'm glad you brought up the bioidentical, because if we don't know if that's, these deficiencies are also being caused by bioidentical, it's important to test so you can actually confirm if that is the case.
Correct.
Okay. Let's talk about another one. I know earlier on in the interview you'd mentioned antibiotics. Can we talk a little bit about those? Because those are commonly prescribed and they cause some pretty big deficiencies as well, and some other factors that we need to think about when it comes to antibiotics.
Yeah, so with one of the things with antibiotics, obviously they destroy good bacteria as well as bad. So if somebody has an infection that's bad enough to merit an antibiotic, I certainly don't want to deter you from using an antibiotic if necessary. I would simply say, if you are being prescribed an antibiotic under the suspicion but not the confirmation that you have a bacterial infection, you might want to reevaluate whether or not you want to take that medication. For example, a lot of times people will go to the doctor and they'll have, maybe a low-grade temperature, but the doctor doesn't do a culture or doesn't discern that it's an actual bacterial infection. I know here in Houston, where I'm located, the majority of infections in our area are not bacterial at all. They're actually mold infections. They're sinus infections where mold will grow in the dark sinuses, and it will, create the same kinds of symptoms as an upper respiratory infection or as a sinus infection. And a lot of doctors prescribe antibiotics which do damage but don't do benefit. So they're not really treating the infection. They're just destroying the GI tract, destroying the good, healthy bacteria that live in the GI tract. So if faced with an antibiotic, always make sure that you confirm with your doctor that the antibiotic is absolutely necessary as opposed to just guesswork on their part. And the reason why is this. Antibiotics knock out good bacteria. Well, if we knock out enough of our good bacteria, you want to understand that the good bacteria is responsible for B vitamin synthesis. 60% of your biotin. Biotin is vitamin B8. It's often referred to as the hair, skin, and nail vitamin. So when we lose this vitamin, a lot of times women will lose their hair, their fingernails will become weak and split, their skin will become thinner. These are very, very common symptoms of biotin deficiency. But biotin deficiency is also extremely related to fat problems. So because biotin's role is in the metabolism of fat, both building and breaking down fats. And realize all of our hormones and neurotransmitters come from fat precursors, right? So estrogen is derived from cholesterol. Progesterone is derived from cholesterol. Both are fat precursors. If we don't have biotin, we can't metabolize our fat appropriately. It's hard for our body to discriminate and get to the point of hormone production. So if we're using an antibiotic and we're destroying 60% of our capacity to create biotin, because that happens right there in the GI tract, and the healthy bacteria are our friends that produce this for us, then again, we can induce a biotin deficiency. Now, earlier I said, Trudy, I said that, you know, most medications, it takes about 6 months of persistent use to really start creating a deficiency. Antibiotics is the exception to the rule. Antibiotics work within a matter of days, and B vitamin deficiency can start and become a problem within a matter of days. So in this example, this is the exception to that rule that I talked about earlier. So we're talking about vitamin BA or biotin, but the other vitamin that's produced largely by our gastrointestinal tract, by our good bacteria, is vitamin K. Now, vitamin K deficiency is strongly linked to bone loss. And I say that because a lot of women who are taking estrogen prescription medications, which we were just talking about, they're taking them for bone loss, right? And maybe these women have a history of antibiotic use that's caused a vitamin K deficiency for a long enough period of time to lead to or contribute to that bone loss. You see what I'm saying? So this is what we were talking about before, where you take one medication for a number of years, it causes nutritional loss, it leads to a second issue that now we're being medicated for another problem. And this is, again, what we're trying to avoid as an overall picture clinically. We're trying to avoid the untoward damage or the unforetold or unforeseen problems that might crop up as a result of not monitoring and measuring nutritional loss associated with medications. Now, some antibiotics can also block calcium, and so if you take your calcium or your iron or your magnesium with the antibiotic, it can actually bind to the antibiotic, and it will make the antibiotic not work as well, but it will also bind to the calcium and prevent it from being absorbed. So there is a blockage effect on certain minerals in the GI tract directly when taking antibiotics, and there is a inhibition effect of B vitamin and vitamin K production by the destruction of good bacteria. And I will also point out, biotin and vitamin K are just two of the biggest examples. As I said before, 60% of our biotin is made in the gut, 40% of our vitamin K is made in the gut, but a number of our other B vitamins are also produced in the gut by our bacteria, and so again, chronic antibiotic use is going to impact other B vitamins as well. Most noted is vitamin B12, because vitamin B12 is largely a process or a product of bacterial production. And so we can start to induce vitamin B12 deficiency through this. And the number one symptom of vitamin B12 deficiency, they're the top two. I will talk about the top two. One is fatigue and the other is anxiety.
That's big, yeah. And that's a very common deficiency that we see as well. And we think of vitamin B12 deficiency when someone may not be getting enough B12 in their diet, and we don't often think about the fact that long-term antibiotic use or frequent antibiotic use may be a contributing factor.
Yeah, it's extremely common. Now, if we're talking about anxiety too, I think it's important, because we're on the topic of antibiotics, to talk about leaky gut or intestinal permeability, because, you know, antibiotics can help to contribute to that process. And there are a number of research studies now showing a process called leaky brain. And leaky brain is very similar. So we have a very similar barrier around our brain. Our blood-brain barrier is very similar to the barrier in our gastrointestinal tract. And if we get a compromised blood-brain barrier, that's what is being called leaky brain, that can actually contribute to chemicals getting into and access to the brain and neurotransmission that don't typically belong there. And that also can be a trigger for a number of conditions, anxiety being one of them. Others that have been studied, epileptic seizure disorders is another one that's being studied.
So the fact that the antibiotic, tell us a little bit more about the connection between leaky gut, and let's just give a definition of what leaky gut is for folks who may not know. I think most people have heard the term leaky gut, but if you could just give a definition of what that actually is, and then how does that lead to leaky brain?
So with leaky gut, if you imagine your gut as like a long tube from your mouth to your anus, it goes through the body, but it is not part of the inside of the body the way the bloodstream is. In other words, the gut is quarantined off from the blood. And there's a reason why that quarantine exists. If we didn't have it, every time we would eat, we would develop anaphylaxis and die. Because there are things in our food that don't belong in our blood, and it's the job of the GI tract to identify those things and excrete them or get rid of them or bind them with bile and excrete them as waste and hang on to the good nutrients. So the gut's job is to hang on to the good, get rid of the bad. And the gut has five primary barriers that are designed to protect us from things leaking through. And this is when we talk about leaky gut. A leaky gut is when those barriers break down and we have almost like microscopic pinholes or perforations in our gut wall. Think of it a lot like if you have a, you know, if you have a garden hose. Imagine a garden hose. When you turn the water on, the water goes from, you know, one end to the other, and it doesn't leak out through the hose along the course of the hose. A leaky gut would be like one of the soaker hoses that are used in gardens where, you know, you turn the water on and there's pinholes and throughout the whole hose itself, and so water is squirting all along the hose, not just from the end. That's what a leaky gut is like, if we want to think about it. And what leaks through a leaky gut, or what can penetrate through into the bloodstream, are proteins, viruses, bacteria, prions, parasitic microorganisms, fungal infections like candida. These are all possibilities. And if these things are leaking into the bloodstream, they're actually inciting inflammatory responses and immune responses. And these now have systemic access to the entire body. Well, this can transfer to the blood-brain barrier, and we can get these same, once the gut becomes leaky, we can start to damage the blood-brain barrier, again, creating that same kind of scenario where now we have a leaky brain. So it's initially, the leakage initially starts in the GI tract. As things leak through, more and more inflammation is created in response to these improper proteins and other chemicals leaking in. And the collateral damage of that is systemic inflammation.
And we know how tied inflammation is to mental health issues. We're seeing a lot of research showing this connection between high levels of CRP and depression and anxiety. And it's obviously one of the contributing factors, as well as some of these nutritional deficiencies that we're talking about.
Well, absolutely. And on that same note, if we're really talking about what do we know can cause a leaky gut, we know infection can cause a leaky gut. We know chronic medication use, antibiotics, antacids are probably two of the most common that we know contribute to it, as well as pain medications like non-steroidal anti-inflammatories such as ibuprofen. But we also know there are some conditions. If you go back in the literature far enough, gluten is one of the major foods that can cause a leaky gut as well as leaky brain. And there's an old term in the medical literature called bread madness, which is one of the earlier known forms of schizophrenia, which is obviously an impact of leaky gut and food proteins triggering inflammation and creating a brain disorder or a psychological disorder.
Interesting. I've not heard that term, bread madness. Do you know who coined that?
You know, it's a number of years old. The last time I saw it brought up was by a Columbia researcher, Dr. Peter Green. He's a celiac researcher at Columbia University, and he talked about bread madness in one of his recent books.
Very interesting, because I know Dr. Carl Pfeiffer talks about the fact that gluten can, you know, definitely brain allergies. He calls them brain allergies. I just had not heard the term bread madness, and that's a good one because it can definitely do that. And it's, as you say, it's one of the common food sensitivities that can cause this leaky gut. We've got the proteins getting into the blood and causing all these problems. So I want to just go back to, you mentioned antacids and NSAIDs. Can we just talk about those quickly? Because I see a lot of people come in and they are on antacids, or they, Prilosec, or, you know, one of those acid-blocking medications. And tell us what sort of problems you might see with antacids, and then we'll have a quick chat about NSAIDs.
I would say antacids are probably public enemy number one. The reason why I say that is because I see more and more infants being prescribed antacids And of course, why? Because we have these formulas that are genetically modified corn and soy that are being pushed down these babies' throats, and they develop irritation in their guts. The doctors are quick to prescribe antacids. And you also have adults who are being prescribed antacids in record numbers. And the problem with blocking stomach acid is very simple. Stomach acid is designed for two major things. It's designed, number one, to prevent infection from penetrating deeper into the small intestine. Mm-hmm. So that acid is actually designed to help to stop or kill potential for infection. But its other function is in digestion. And let's think about this for a minute. A lot of people think of food as this, you know, social grace, right? We can eat what we want. It really doesn't impact our health. I'll pay for it tomorrow, but it's just food and it's not a big deal. But food is actually, eating is actually warfare. And a lot of people don't think of it this way. It's your gut against whatever it is that you put in your mouth, right? Because your gut's job is to basically steal and take from the life forces or forms that you're putting in your body, is to take the good and excrete the bad. So it's a battle. And, you know, acid is a powerful tool in that battle. Acid helps to break down protein. So if you block it, you know, what is the primary ingredient that goes into the formation of serotonin, dopamine, epinephrine, acetylcholine, all these neurotransmitters that we're talking about contribute to anxiety? It's protein. Protein is the precursor to this. So if you take a person and you hinder their ability to process protein, to digest it, you in essence cause low-grade protein malnourishment coupled with the high-carbohydrate diets, at least in America, and people are already over-consuming carbohydrates and sugars, which changes the bacteria in the gut and changes the nature of how we produce acid. And then we take antacids because our guts are irritated, and now we're blocking our protein absorption. Acid is also required to absorb vitamin B12, magnesium, calcium, iron, zinc, vitamin B2, vitamin A, L-glutamine. We could keep going. The list is very, very long. But blocking acid is one of the worst things that you can do for a stomach problem. As a matter of fact, we don't really want to block the acid. We want to figure out why the stomach is irritated, and it's not always irritated because of too much acid. Sometimes it's irritated because we're eating foods that irritate it, and that feels like acid. So a doctor makes an assumption, oh, it sounds like you have acid reflux. Here's a bunch of antacids. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And we've got to get to the root cause of the problem instead of just putting this Band-Aid on, which is then going to cause these other issues. And food intolerances and food sensitivities are big ones. And gluten is a big one. A lot of people who have this feel like they need antacids actually find out that it's a gluten intolerance. Would you recognize that?
Oh, without a doubt, gluten intolerance is a huge issue. For acid reflux. What we're not sure. Well, we know that there are proteins in wheat and barley and rye and oats and corn and sorghum and some of these other grains that will trigger any irritation in the GI lining. We also know that a number of the GMOs, there's actually some researchers in Australia studying this in infants, that a number of the GMOs cause irritation. So gluten aside, just the fact that a product might be genetically modified in and of itself can create an irritation to the gut lining and contribute to acid reflux-like symptoms. And we also know that a number of other things in the environment. In Houston, there are 42 prescription medications that have been identified in the drinking water. And, you know, the FDA will say, oh, none of the doses are high enough to really create a drug-like effect. But you and I both know, Trudy, that when you mix two drugs together, we have this process called synergism, which can exponentially increase the effectiveness of a drug. And so an example of that might be, you know, in the 1990s, people were taking aspirin and caffeine and ephedra as weight loss supplements. Taking caffeine by itself, not a big deal. Mixing aspirin and ephedra to it increased its effectiveness 100-fold, and it was causing people's hearts to race out of their chests. It was causing severe anxiety in a number of people because it was just increasing and accelerating heart rate. way too high. Well, that's an example of drug synergism. When you mix and match multitudes of different drugs, you increase the risk for synergism. And, you know, again, as I said, here in Houston, there's 42 prescriptive medications that have been identified in the drinking water that don't get filtered by the city's water filtering capacity or capability. And what that is in other states, what that is in other cities, you know, I haven't studied in great detail. It might be something that you all want to look into as you're thinking about this. Either that or just filtering your water, because, again, that can impact the status of your gut, right? That can impact the status of how it's supposed to properly produce mucus and how it's supposed to properly digest, et cetera.
Wow, Dr. Osborne, that's a scary number, 42 prescription meds in your drinking water. How would a person find out what might be in their city's water? Contacting the water board?
Contacting the water board, and you might not find it through that information. The report that last report I saw was about, I want to say it was about 5 years ago, and it was put out by the Associated Press, and there were independent studies that were being done on a number of cities throughout the U.S. So what I would do if I were, you know, trying to research this is I would type in Associated Press drugs and drinking water across the U.S. as a search term in a search engine and see what you might be able to find in that report, because I know that the original report was written and it was published. I just don't remember the journal that it was published in.
Okay. Maybe we'll look for that and share it on the blog if we find it. And then tell us what type of filter would filter out these medications.
Well, primarily the best types of water filtration devices, you know, to pull everything is reverse osmosis. Now, some people don't like to use RO because it pulls the minerals out of the water. I'm not opposed at all to RO because I think if a person's eating enough fresh fruits and vegetables, they're going to be getting the same minerals through their diet through that, and they don't have to worry about. I mean, drinking water is not a major source of minerals in anyone's diet, but food is, and I would say you're better off filtering the potential drugs out of the water using RO than not. Some people use granular activated carbon combined with something called KDF. KDF is a zinc and copper alloy that pulls out a number of different chemicals and compounds, so the combination of those types of filters also works well. My advice would be to talk to a local reputable water filtration company who could maybe even come out and test your own water to discern what filter would work best for the area that you live in.
Yeah, because there's many different chemicals that can be in different water sources depending on where you are.
Absolutely. I once had a patient, she was infertile. She came to see me because, you know, her hormones were completely opposite of what they should be. And what we found was she had so much fluoride in her drinking water that was the cause. It was the fluoride. So we actually had to put RO filtration on her system in order to get her to have normal hormone output again. And it worked quite well once we got rid of the fluoride and chelated the rest of the fluoride that was stuck in her out of her. She made a full recovery and she has a child today.
Wonderful. I love it. And do we know for a fact that reverse osmosis would pull the prescription medications out?
It's pretty much going to pull everything.
Okay.
It's hands down, it's the best filter for pulling pretty much everything out of the water. There is no 100% perfect in any filtration that you would use. The name of and there's no perfect drinking water in the world either. I mean, even if you were to drink the purest mountain stream water, you could get potentially dysentery from bacteria, right? So, you know, I mean, it's the best of the best, in my opinion, as far as technology has to offer today.
Okay. So tell us, how are the meds getting in the drinking water? Is this just because of people on medications going to the bathroom and then also possibly flushing meds down the toilet, or where is it coming from?
Yeah, both, all of the above. So some people take their medicines and they don't fully metabolize them, and they're urinating them out into our circulation, our water circulation. Other people will pour out old drugs, they'll pull them out down the toilet. So those also end up in circulation. The problem was so bad here in this area. There have actually been a number of pharmacy recall programs where a person can bring their old prescriptions into the pharmacy for proper elimination.
Great. Important to know. Thanks. I'm glad we brought that one up. So I do want to talk about testing, but we did say we would briefly talk about NSAIDs. And a lot of people are using these anti-inflammatory drugs, and I'd love to just talk a little bit about them, and then we'll go on to testing.
Sure. So, yeah, pain medication is the number one prescribed and over-the-counter medication, period. So more people are trying to fight pain and inflammation than anything else. And ibuprofen and aspirin, which are two of the most common, one of their side effects, both of those particular types of medications deplete iron, they deplete vitamin C, and they also deplete folate, which is ironic because if you have pain, you know, especially like joint arthritis, you need vitamin C to repair cartilage. So if you're on this medication long enough and you're depleting vitamin C aggressively enough, your joint will actually never heal and repair, so you become dependent on the medication. Now, so we've got those three primary nutrients that's being depleted, but we also have one of the other side effects. If you look at ibuprofen, if you look at aspirin on the label, it will warn you very clearly, this product needs to be taken with food. It can cause gastric bleeding and gastric ulcers and erosions. It's because these products strip away the mucosal layer, which is, think of it like snot that lines the gut, okay? It's a coating. It's a barrier, right? It's mucus. And inside that mucus, one, we have antibodies, primarily an antibody called IgA, immunoglobulin A, specifically secretory or secretory immunoglobulin A. It is the first line of defense antibody that our gut makes to protect us from bad guys. So if we erode that mucus layer, we're going to impact the quality of those antibodies. The other thing is the mucosal layer serves as a foothold for our healthy and good bacteria. So it's kind of how they get a foothold and stay and hang out and hang around. And so if we strip away large areas of mucus that line our GI tract, not only are we stripping away a barrier, we're stripping away a foothold for good bacteria, and we're also stripping away our ability for our immune system, our IgA, to properly secrete and work within the GI tract itself.
Wow, lots of effects there. That's scary. And then you mentioned folate again, and that together with iron is important for making neurotransmitters and all the other things you mentioned earlier. So we've got a lot of bad effects there.
Right, and I've seen a number of patients who the way they presented with a problem was chronic iron deficiency anemia. And if we looked at their history, what we would see in many cases was chronic pain medication use. And again, this is primarily non-steroidal anti-inflammatories. It's not Tylenol. It's not drugs that treat migraine headaches per se. When I say that, I mean it's not steroidal anti-inflammatories that have this effect that we know of.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've covered quite a few meds here, and this has been really excellent. I would love to now talk about how do you detect these deficiencies, because we can run certain tests and we can actually ascertain if we do have a deficiency of a specific nutrient. Let's talk about that for a little bit.
So there are a number of labs that can be used. My favorite lab to use for actual testing of vitamin and mineral deficiencies is a lab, they're out of Houston actually, and their name is SpectraCell, SpectraCell Labs, SpectraCell. And I think their website is SpectraCell.com. If you want to learn a little bit more about them, you can. I'm not a paid spokesman. I'm not a paid affiliate for that lab. I just find that from a technological perspective, they offer the best at identifying vitamin and mineral deficiencies. The technology is based on about 20 years of research at the University of Texas, and to my knowledge, it is the only test that measures large quantities of nutrients simultaneously from the same blood sample that gives us an average of a six-month window of nutritional status. Just like a hemoglobin A1C test for doctors who are monitoring diabetes gives an average of 3 months' levels of blood sugars, this particular test gives us a six-month average of nutritional adequacy or inadequacy in a person. And so what we measure all the B vitamins, including folate and B12 and B6, but also others that we know are depleted by certain medications and others that can induce or lead to symptoms of anxiety, like vitamin B1 and vitamin B2 and niacin. Niacin, one of the primary symptoms of niacin deficiency can be anxiety, which is vitamin B3. But we also measure things like calcium and magnesium and zinc and copper and selenium and chromium. And see, these are all minerals that play a role in, one, in neurochemical, neurotransmitter formation that would have an impact on thought and behavior. But they also play huge roles in blood sugar regulation, which, as you know, blood sugar dysregulation is a huge factor in anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
There are other tests. This is one of my primary tests that I use, but I also use other tests that can give me additional information. Pyrouria can sometimes give us information about zinc and vitamin B6. It's measuring a compound in the urine. There are other tests like glutathione peroxidase. It can be measured. There's actually an enzyme called erythrocyte glutathione transferase, which is an enzyme that is a marker for glutathione and vitamin B2 deficiency. Then there's something called the transketolase activity coefficient test, which is another marker for vitamin B6 deficiency. So and this is one of those things where we get too technical into some of these names because they're, one, the testing themselves are not real common, so most doctors haven't heard of it. And that's why another reason why I like SpectraCell, because it gives you so much for so little, and all a doctor really has to do is go and get an account with that particular lab so that they can order that test for their patient. Super simple, an easy way to measure nutritional status very, very quickly.
So these, just to get going back to these, the last three that you mentioned, the one that's a marker for B2 deficiency and the B6 deficiency, are those part of the SpectraCell test?
No, those are enzyme-based tests. So,
okay.
Now, there's another lab, and a lot of doctors use it, and I don't want to say their name just simply because I'm not saying they're a bad company or a bad lab. I just, from a technology perspective and from an accuracy perspective, I want you to understand where I'm coming from. When we run lab tests, some labs will give us actual outcomes. So, like, one of the reasons I like SpectraCell because it's an outcomes-based test. In other words, we can measure your vitamin and deficiency levels based on whether or not your cells are capable of growing. So the test is dependent on the person. It's dependent on the function of the person's cells and not dependent on something else, like a level, like in the serum. So if we're measuring B12 in the blood, that is a level that is not outcome-dependent. And it is actually just a doctor saying, we're going to measure you and compare you to the last 10,000 people who had this test done who we thought were normal, right? So it's a comparative lab test is not very accurate because the ranges that are used change every several months based on the last sample of population of people that have had the test done. But because also the tests are not outcome-oriented. So a person can be B12 deficient and have very normal serum B12 levels, but be told that B12 is not an issue for them. When in actuality, it very much is an issue for them. It's just that the lab test was a poor measure or a poor marker to identify that deficiency. So functional outcomes type testing, I know you've heard the term functional medicine before. These are tests that mostly functional medicine doctors will look at. They're outcomes-based testing. Well, there's a very popular lab out there, and they do what I call extrapolatory testing. And what that means is, I'm going to give you an example first. If you walk outside and the driveway is wet, what is your first assumption, Trudy? What would you say is the first thought in your head?
That it rained.
Oh, perfect, exactly, right? And that would be my first assumption, too. But what if it didn't rain? What if the garden hose was left on overnight? What if the sprinklers were on that morning? What if a hose busted? What if somebody washed their car? Do you see all these other possibilities, right?
Mm-hmm.
So when we extrapolate information based on a guesstimation, right, we can oftentimes be wrong. And you know, in my job, what I try to do is I try to take as much of the guesswork out of the equation as possible and be as accurate as I can possibly be. And so there's some lab tests that work based on extrapolation. And those lab tests, they measure byproducts. So, for example, B12 deficiency can cause an elevation in homocysteine levels. And some doctors will measure homocysteine levels, and if a patient has high homocysteine, the doctor will assume that it's caused as a result of a B12 deficiency. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Just like we assume the driveway was wet because it rained. Now, it could that the homocysteine can be elevated because of B6 deficiency or B2 deficiency or folate deficiency or because of genetic mutations that occur. So, again, if we use extrapolatory tests, we can oftentimes be wrong in trying to help that patient accurately. So, again, going back to why I like that particular lab, that SpectroCell lab, is because it takes extrapolation out of the equation and gives us an average of the last 6 months of nutritional status of an individual.
So, Dr. Osborne, does the SpectroCell test B12, is that one of the ones that it tests?
Absolutely.
So you prefer that over testing B12, the homocysteine, and the methylmalonic acid? Do you find that that's a more accurate indication of what's going on because of this extrapolation?
I do, and I've actually done a number of comparisons on this very topic where we've measured homocysteine methylmalonic acid levels in hundreds of patients, compared it to their lymphocyte proliferative values, which is what the way SpectroCell measures, and we find that B12 is present in a large percentage of those who have normal homocysteine and methylmalonic acid values.
So you're saying the deficiency of B12 exists even though they've got the normal homocysteine and MMA, methylmalonic acid?
Exactly.
Very interesting.
And one of the reasons why this can happen is the body is just so good at adaptation,
mm-hmm.
right? The body can throw other nutrients. You know, we see this very commonly with thyroid. You know, the body will substitute bromine or chloride for iodine, and will still make thyroid hormone. It just won't work as well. And the body is very, very good at adaptation that way. And we see the same kind of process occur when we're measuring vitamin and mineral status.
Okay, very interesting. Good to know. Now, I do want to just go back to those two three questions. One is you mentioned pyroluria. So which lab do you use for pyroluria testing?
You know, the lab, I'll have to send you the link because off the top of my head, I don't remember the name of the lab. I used to do a lot more pyroluria testing than I do today. The same thing occurs in that we're measuring that outcome versus the B6 and the zinc on a SpectroCell test. I just find that it's much more accurate than doing pyroluria testing.
Good to know, because I don't do pyroluria testing much myself. I use the questionnaire and other markers. I like to look at alkaline phosphatase on blood and GGTP on blood. Do you find that those correlate with what you're seeing on the SpectroCell?
They do sometimes, but a lot of times we'll see very normal chemistries and the presence of an abnormal SpectroCell nutritional relationship.
Okay. Good to know. And then I would love to just go back to those two that you mentioned, the B2 and the B6. Could you just mention them again? You said glutathione peroxidase, which is a marker for B2. Is that correct?
It's a lymphocyte glutathione coefficient activity. It's a type of test that measures the enzyme that converts glutathione based on vitamin B2. So in essence, vitamin B2 helps to regenerate oxidized glutathione, okay? Or think of glutathione like a battery, right? It's a master antioxidant. Think of it like a battery. It once it's used up, the battery is dead, but the battery can be recharged. And that battery is recharged by an enzyme that is driven by vitamin B2. And that's the enzyme coefficient that we're measuring.
Okay.
The same thing can be said for the erythrocyte transketolase activity coefficient enzyme, which is for vitamin B6.
Okay. But if you're using the SpectroCell, do you find that you also need to do these two tests, Or is the SpectraCell going to give you a nudge?
I don't. The only reason I mention it is because if any of your audience is overseas, it's going to be really hard for your doctor to order this particular SpectraCell test because the blood has to be shipped overnight to the lab, and it's really hard to make that happen overseas. So these are just other options that doctor, if he knows enough about biochemistry and clinical lab diagnosis, can go back and he can look at some of these other tests that can be measured.
Okay, got it. Good to know. Now, one quick question on testing. Now, if you've got a low, you've got a need for hydrochloric acid, do you look at markers on like total protein and globulin and albumin as an indication that someone may need a hydrochloric acid?
Yeah, we do that. As I always run a complete chemistry and CBC on every patient. To make sure that we're covering other bases, even though some of those may be extrapolatory, we still want that information and that data. But yes, so to answer your question, yes, I am looking at those parameters and those factors. The other thing that we look at is I have 182 questions that I ask all my patients before they come into my office.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of these are gut-based, digestive-based questions, and we look at that very closely. Because there's no great definitive test to measure stomach acid output, at least non-invasive. And so we want to know as much as we can. Now, one of the best things to do is to actually do a betaine hydrochloric acid test. If you've got somebody with maldigestion of protein, every time they eat meat, they don't feel very well. They feel bloated. They feel groggy. They feel brain fog. You can actually give them betaine hydrochloride. And what we typically do is we just have them titrate their doses up to a point where if they don't ever feel a change or a difference after ingesting, heavy quantities of protein, then, you know, the proof is in the pudding. The likelihood that they have an acid deficiency in their stomach production is very, very low.
Okay, great. And then just explain what happens when someone's titrating up. What are they looking for? What would be an indication that now they've got enough?
So the symptoms initially might be gastric bloating, brain fog, fatigue after that meal. And I'm not talking about minor because most people eat and the blood goes from the brain to the gut for digestion, and there is a little bit of nappy feeling that most people are going to have after a meal. I'm talking about severe brain fog, severe bloating, IBS-like symptoms of the GI tract after protein introduction. And so what we do is we'll start on low doses of betaine hydrochloride and just kind of work it up, titrate it up until they feel a burning in their stomach. If they get to the point where they feel a real slight burning in their stomach but they don't feel any improvements on their digestion, then the realistic possibility that it's an acid problem isn't very high at all.
Okay. But if they do feel the burning and they feel better, that means they reach the limit of what they would need for the hydrochloric acid.
Yes.
Okay, great. Well,
so to tie that in, I want to tie that in with one other thing because we mentioned earlier antacid medications, and some people have been on them for years and years and years, and so they've had suppression of their acid production. And sometimes to get them to be able to recover, you have to do that. Even though they don't have an intrinsic stomach problem, they just have years of stomach acid reduction, and we have to give their body time for that to recoup. But the other aspect of that is gluten. We know that gluten, there's an autoimmune disease called pernicious anemia, and it is a vitamin B12 deficiency, not because of the absence of vitamin B12, but because of the autoimmune damage to the ability to absorb B12, which has a lot to do with stomach acid.
Great.
So we know, bottom line, is one of the most common side effects of gluten exposure is damage to the parietal cell in the stomach. The parietal cells are the cell type in the stomach that are largely responsible for the production of hydrochloric acid, as well as a compound called intrinsic factor. Intrinsic factor is the taxicab for vitamin B12. So if we have gluten-induced damage of the stomach parietal cells, we can actually have long-term vitamin B12 deficiency that leads to anxiety, neuropathy, mood swings, behavioral disorders, and chronic anemias, because B12 deficiency can also cause anemia, which is a non-iron deficiency anemia, but an anemia nonetheless.
Great. Well, this is a perfect ending because I wanted to talk about gluten because I know it's a primary area of focus of yours. And you've tied this in beautifully, how this gluten sensitivity can, in fact, cause nutritional deficiencies. And what you've described is obviously one way that it can happen. Earlier on, you talked about leaky gut. That's another way. So we can see that this can cause some of these nutritional deficiencies and in turn contribute to anxiety as well. And I'd love you to just share a little bit about the Gluten-Free Society, because I know this is an organization that you founded to help educate patients and physicians about gluten sensitivity. So tell us a little bit about this, and then we'll end up.
I started Gluten-Free Society about 4 years ago, mainly because of a patient of mine. It was a young boy, and early in my practice, he was one of my very first autoimmune cases in private practice. He had juvenile rheumatoid arthritis, and he had been given 6 months to live. The little boy, he had a permanent stent embedded in his arm because he was in and out of the hospital so frequently.
Oh.
And, the Make-A-Wish Foundation granted his wish. That's how terminal he was, Trudy. I mean, but to have the Make-A-Wish Foundation grant you your wish, that you know you've got a problem. And so we tested him. He was gluten sensitive. Here was the big problem was his mom did not want to take gluten away from him because it was his favorite food. Pizza was his favorite food. And could you imagine being a mom and your son, his favorite food is pizza, and he's got 6 months to live, and that's what he wants to eat. But I mean, what a horrible position to be in. I can completely see why initially this mom didn't want to take her son gluten-free. So she went gluten-free herself. Now, she had rheumatoid arthritis, and within a matter of weeks to months, her symptoms were dramatically improved and reduced. And it was at that point that she made the decision to take her son gluten-free with her as well. Now, today, this young boy is now a teenager. He's in high school band. He's off all medications. He's got the stent out of his arm, and he's alive because he changed his diet.
Wow.
To me, nothing is more powerful than the ability to take somebody who's terminally ill, and all they have to do is change their diet, and they can live, and not just live and live miserably, but blossom into a young adult. And it was at that point that I knew I had to be able to reach more people, because in my clinic, I see 300 to 400 new patients a year. You know, it's just me. I have a small clinic. You can't scale personalized care. So, you know, how do you scale knowledge and information? We went to the drawing board. My team and I went to the drawing board a number of times. How can we get this information out to more people who potentially could have their lives saved? And that's how Gluten-Free Society was born. And so what differentiates the Gluten-Free Society from, in my experience and opinion, and is every other gluten-free website that I see out there, and maybe I'm saying every other. Again, this is my experience, so I'm not speaking for every site on the Internet, because I'm sure there are others that share similar values that my site does. But to my knowledge, the ones that I see that are out there promote gluten-free products and GMO and promote garbage food. And you know, they're there to try to be a guide for people trying to figure out how to go gluten-free. But the problem is their guidance is just promoting junk food. And you know, the three cardinal rules of nutrition, Trudy, that nobody can escape. I don't care who you are. Rule number one, you can't get healthy eating food that isn't healthy. Rule number two, never eat what you're allergic, sensitive, or intolerant to. And rule number three, if you feel bad when you eat it, stop eating it. So those three rules have to be thought about in terms of why are we making such a huge diet change? We're not making it because we want to go gluten-free because it's cool and trendy. We're making it because our health is so deteriorated that we want to improve upon the state of our health. So why would I then take a sick person and inject them with a bunch of garbage that we're calling gluten-free and say that that's a better option? Right? And so Gluten-Free Society was founded out of the need to bring real information about real nutrition to people who were being marketed to and being, I guess you could say, miscommunicated to, being lied to in many cases, or deceived by the food industry and the processed food market that exist today that's, you know, a $5 billion industry, largely over garbage food, over junk food. And much of what they call gluten-free, you know, we traditionally, we call corn a gluten-free grain. We call rice a gluten-free grain. We call sorghum a gluten-free grain. And the reality is this, there's no such thing as a gluten-free grain. There are thousands of different forms of gluten. And of all of these different forms of gluten, we've only studied a handful of them. But when we look at large-scale studies where we've taken patients grain-free, not necessarily wheat, barley, and rye-free, we see infinitely better results than just going wheat, barley, and rye-free. And this has been proven at least 30 times in medical research studies. I'm not the guy who's done the studies. I'm just the guy who reports and provides this information to the public. But that's why we founded it, because there was this huge gap of knowledge that was not getting to the public. If you get a diagnosis of celiac disease at a major hospital in the United States, you usually get a care package that's full of genetically modified, sugar-loaded garbage food, under, you know, where the doctor says it's okay to eat this stuff. So the very doctor who's supposed to be entrusted with your health is telling you to go eat garbage. You can see I'm upset about this, but that had to be stopped. And so that's the other reason why we founded Gluten-Free Society. We wanted that information to be readily available to anybody who was struggling through the diet, not understanding why they weren't getting better. Because as you know, Trudy, when a patient doesn't get better with a diet change, they quit and they go back to the old way and they just stay sick, but without the stress of diet change. Now, if we can induce a diet change that gets them healthy, you know, the old saying, nothing tastes as good as it feels to be healthy, then we can get those people on the right track and educated, and those people can tell their friends, and their friends can tell their friends, and we create a movement, a grassroots movement that strips away the power of the powers that be that are misinforming and undereducating and keeping people in the dark about what they can do to improve their health.
Great. Well, I can hear you very passionate about this, and I'm so glad you talk about these gluten-free products, because a lot of people say, oh, how am I going to go gluten-free? It's so expensive. All these gluten-free products cost so much, and we shouldn't be eating them. They're junk. A lot of them are, you know, very processed and loaded with sugar, and it's often processed rice flour, so that's a problem. So I'm really glad that you are doing this and getting this message out, and I love the wonderful story of your young client who had juvenile rheumatoid arthritis. What a wonderful, wonderful outcome, and how wonderful that he could, you know, blossom. I just love that. And I love your comment about nothing tastes as good as it feels to be healthy. That's a beautiful ending. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Really great, Dr. Osborne. Well, this has been fabulous. I want to just share that you've got a gift. It is 7 Highly Effective Habits of the Gluten-Free Warrior. It's a 3-part video series, which is fabulous, and we'll make sure that we have a link to that on the website. And I just want to ask if there's any final words of wisdom that you have, Dr. Osborne.
I would just simply say that if you're struggling to work your health, to get your health where you want it to be, first and foremost, if you're working by yourself, find somebody who's a qualified functional medicine doctor who can help you, guide you through the steps. Don't let the frustration overwhelm you. Don't let the frustration pull you down and not allow you to achieve the success that you deserve. Nobody is born in this world to be sick. I truly believe that no matter what the condition, no matter what the disease, there's a way to improve it if we just have the ability to implement functional, customized nutrition and medicine as opposed to, you know, the standard, everybody with this problem gets this drug. So keep those things in mind as you move forward. If you gleaned anything from this conversation today, at the very least, go have a talk with your doctor if you're on any prescription medications and get to the bottom of drug-induced nutritional deficiencies. I think that's a really great first place to start.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Osborne. This has been fantastic. Wealth of information. We got information on drugs and nutritional deficiencies and gluten as well. So I appreciate your time. I appreciate your passion. And thanks again for joining us. And everyone, thanks so much for joining us on another fabulous call on the Anxiety Summit. I look forward to hearing you on one of the other calls. Thank you. This is Trudy Scott signing off.